are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, October 18th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Peter Fraze, editor at the Jacobin magazine, on the four futures. What comes after capitalism? There's a great scenario, a terrible scenario, a decent scenario, and a really terrible scenario. Let's talk about which ones are the most probable. Also, NASA, more disastrous climate data for us. You know, it's always the hottest year, the hottest month, because we never deal with that problem. A big incursion in Mosul with U.S. air support. Kurdish Peshmerga forces making their move. John McCain reminding everyone that he's an a-hole, says that when Hillary Clinton is president, Republicans will filibuster all of her SCOTUS picks as well. So Mr. Country First, who gave us Sarah Palin, is now pretty much committed, along with his fellow extremists in the Republican Party, to completely paralyzing government. Hillary Clinton unveils a decent small-scale anti-poverty program that will make a small dent in the disastrous legacy of welfare reform signed by her husband and supported by her. And Melania Trump is going to explain to us why her husband did what he did with Billy Bush. Of course, it does not involve Donald Trump. He was being... Billy Bush is a bad man. A very bad man. Nicki Minaj is getting in on this election, and she has thoughts on Mrs. Trump. A little bit more on the WikiLeaks emails. Nancy Pelosi with a smart response on one of the more distasteful comments that have come out of the email leak. And Donald Trump continues to sink and sink and claim that he has actually never crossed the line with women. Paul Ryan assures us that a Democratic Senate victory is a victory for Bernie Sanders, which is as great a reason to get out and vote for Democratic Senate candidates as I can imagine. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Before I get to the check-ins, I just want to talk to you about something that, believe it or not, I actually do think about. It actually is important. And it is data visualization and moving into the fastest possible way of doing that. I'm not a big tech guy, as everybody knows, but it's important for organizing yourself, any type of collaborative work you do, whether it's producing a show, whether it's getting data analytics you need. Even as an example with Two Dope Boys, we're building a podcast list of places that other hosts we might want to invite on, hosts that shows we should be on, shows that are in our ecosystem. And Periscope data is the ultimate tool for fast and flexible data visualization. Why run slow queries on old spreadsheet data with Periscope when Periscope data allows you to run, visualize, and share analyses of over a billion data rows in a second? Answer the big question. Instead of running a routine SQL SQL task again and again and again, Periscope data is fast, powerful, and effortless to connect. See, there are three kinds of fast. Blazing fast query execution powered by massive Amazon clusters. Fast workflow designed by analysts, for analysts, by analysts, to help you accomplish your tasks as effortlessly as possible. So these are people that are in the thick of it themselves. They understand this process, how it works, and they designed it for you on the ground level. That's why it's so fast and efficient. Fast sharing, internal collaboration, external sharing, and embedding in your apps takes moments with zero NetApp costs or time. Traditional BL takes over a month to get your ETL configured. With Periscope, you can get trialing and delivering insights as soon as you plug in your credentials. No giant statements of work, no top-heavy meetings, just you and your data. You're easily reversible. It takes one click to disconnect if you decide you don't want to move forward. Plug and play for immediate use and immediate values. No uploading, no copying, no hassle. Periscope Data is a powerful and intuitive tool that will bring you SQL analysis to the next level. Get a free trial today by going to periscopedata.com/majority. That's periscopedata.com/majority. periscopedata.com/majority. How was everyone's weekend or extended weekend? Monday evenings.
My weekend was good. I don't know if I mentioned
any new exciting outings.
I had an outing on Friday night, but the more exciting thing was I watched 7 Days in May. It's like a 1964 movie written by Rod Serling about a military coup. The Marines take over attempt to take over the government, and it was actually surprisingly better. It was very interesting to see
MacArthur.
Like, when the state was that big and like you had the military industrial complex. Like it really captured the creepy mood of what that looks like. You're going to like the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And now it's all just like outsourced.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's all contractors.
Now it's all just contractors and like corporate mercenaries and hired killers. New Two Dope Boys dropping today with Mr. Rob Fields. We talk about can online dating transcend the swipe culture? Facebook Live lying about its analytics and what? No, that wasn't it. Excuse me. What else did we talk about? Tell me.
Well, there was the brand F Up, which was I'm forgetting.
Oh, that's fine.
I had a weekend as well.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you.
I was transitioning to you.
No, that's okay.
Go ahead.
My dog got her first haircut.
Okay, she's doing well. She's in good health, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And it was so cute.
Why didn't you bring in pictures?
I did.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to see those.
Okay. And
Kelly is a very cute dog.
They called her the big dog, which she's not, I guess, in for Brooklyn. It was, and so I got confused, and I was like, I don't know. And they're like, the happy big dog. And I was like, okay. And apparently she's the happy big dog, even though she weighs 30 pounds.
That's so cute.
And I went to a birthday party at a heavy metal karaoke bar, which was...
Where was that at?
It was awful. Not the
I didn't want to
people
be the one to
that
say
I was
it.
With, but the venue. I was just like, why would I want to be here? Where was it? Queens.
Oh, okay. Sounds like a Queens thing. You got the Dope Boys information?
Yeah, it's Samsung's Note 7s keep blowing up. And right. Then another, who is Luis DeLange, which was a social media campaign showing that it was this woman who got popular on social
right.
media. And then it was determined that it was actually a campaign showing that problem drinking gets you likes on Instagram and that sort of thing. And it
yeah.
was very interesting.
So it was an inverse of a social marketing campaign to expose basically struggles with addiction. Yeah, no. Yeah, it was French. It was a French agency, exactly. So subscribe to Dope Boys and a podcast on iTunes. Everything is moving up with that show, and we're getting a lot of positive feedback, and I'm really excited about it, and I hope you'll join us. Now, I've encountered another great podcast recently, and it's called Secrets, Crimes, and Audiotape. It's an audio drama that's told week after week. So it features stories about crime, love, mystery, conspiracy with actors you know and love. Some are dramas, some are comedies. And there's several episodes that have already been released. There is The Love Contract, which is actually kind of about, it's a sort of like comedy of bureaucratic torture is the best I could describe it. That's funny. I was listening to Air Force One, which is an arc about the JFK assassination. Now, I think it might annoy people in this audience because, but you should hear it anyways. It starts off with an interview that sort of sets up the play about with a guy who knows a lot about Lee Harvey Oswald, gets into Oswald's background, takes as a given that there was a lone gunman, which I'm sure many people, including Mr. Matt, would strongly object to. But it's fascinating even getting that bio and that background and also being reminded that whether he was a lone gunman or a patsy or part of a larger conspiracy. Rafael Cruz's sidekick. He was only 24 years old. And then it gets into the actual play. And there's an arc around Jacqueline Kennedy's distrust of LBJ and the immediate aftermath of the assassination. I like it. It's kind of like it's like updated old school radio drama. And it's really fun to listen to. A new episode drops every Tuesday. Make sure you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audio Tape on iTunes, Stitcher, or Wondery.com, wherever you listen to podcasts. It's like your favorite TV, drama, or comedy, but using only sound in your imagination. Every week, Love Contract, Air Force One. I listened to both and enjoyed them. And I listened while I was shaving because I am an efficient multitasker operating in late-stage capitalism. And if you're an efficient multitasker operating in late-stage capitalism, you need to know about Harry's razors. They tell me to share my specific enjoyment of Harry's. And my specific enjoyment of Harry's is that it helps me be an efficient multitasker in late-stage capitalism. But I also love the closeness of the shave, the smooth, comfortable glide. And let me just say, when it comes to other products available on the market, for price and quality and convenience, there is just literally no comparison. I mean, maybe there's like some secret like Mongolian razor that's like, you know, handmade in a city in Mongolia, not available anywhere outside of it, that's really amazing but totally inaccessible.
But they don't ship to your door.
But they do not ship to your door, and the price point would be insane. And they probably still wouldn't be as good as Harry's, okay? The big razors companies have an annoying habit of putting out new models and raising their already high prices. Unlike those guys, Harry's doesn't believe in upcharging, which is why they made their razors even better, and they're keeping the prices exactly the same. Harry's five blades now include a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places, a lubricating strip, and a textured handle for more control when it's wet. Still just $2 a blade compared to $4 that you'll pay at the drugstore. By owning a factory in Germany where they make the blades, Harry's can produce high-quality razors themselves and sell them online for half the price. And this is a special offer now for Majority Report listeners, members of the Majority Militia. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades that they'll send you their popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Free when you sign up for a shaving plan. Just pay shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of the show. Enter Majority Report at checkout and get a post-shaving balm added to your order for free. That's Harry's. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter promo code Majority Report at checkout and claim your free trial and post-balm shave. That's harrys.com. Code Majority Report. Link to it on the website. We will be right back with Peter Fraze on the Majority Report. Hey yo, the brother's still mad. I crawled up out of that grave, wiping the dirt, cleaning my shirt. They thought I'd make another illmatic, but it's always forward. I'm moving, never back from stupid. Here's another classic. C notes is falling from the sky. By now, the credits roll. The star and Nas, executive poet, produced, directed by the kids / Escobar. Narration describes the lives of lost tribes in the ghetto trying to survive. The feature opens with this young black child. Fingers scratch, cigarette burns on the sofa. Turning the TV down, or maybe Jane Girls. 45s playing, soft in the background. Food from C-Towns, mornings was hash brown. Stepped over fiends, walking out the door. All of us poor. I learned the difference between the snitches, the real ones, and who's soft in the...
hungry as crews, people jumping from roofs. Pumping, made it through my youth, walking very thin lines, ages 7 and 9, that's the age I was on my album cover. This is the rebirth, I know the streets thirst water like Moses, walking through the hot desert, searching to be free. This is my ending and my new beginning, nostalgia, alpha and omega places. It's like a glitch in the matrix, I seen it all, did it all, most of y'all are pop for a minute, spit a sentence, then a game and get rid of y'all. Y'all got there, but y'all ain't get it all, I want my style back, hate the C-Shot plan, it's the rap repo man, to them double up hustle. Bitters, real, professional, kids dreaming for meals. Let my words guide you, get inside you.
All right, welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Peter Fraze. He's an editor at the Jacobin Magazine and author of The Four Futures, Life After Capitalism. Peter, how you doing?
Great, great to be here again.
Yeah, it's really good to be speaking with you again. I really, really enjoyed the initial article in the Jacobin that sort of inspired the book, and I just finished reading a copy of the book that came out just recently on Verso, and it's fascinating. You outline four scenarios for where we could go in a post-capital world. I want you to get to those four scenarios, but to get there, I want you to explain how you use science fiction and that type of literature and pop culture reference in this book. It's an area that I'll admit it's a genre that I'm not very familiar with at all. So I kind of opened it up with not skepticism, but a sort of lack of familiarity. So I didn't really see how it was going to play into the arguments. But you synchronized it really well with the four scenarios that you outlined. So talk about the use of those texts, those pieces of pop culture, and then use that as a doorway to get us into the four post-capitalist scenarios you see.
Sure. So the use of science fiction, I mean, I've always read a lot of speculative fiction. And then it sort of fit into this book because I was trying to write something that wasn't just talking about the immediate political tasks going forward, but to try to think a little farther into the future about really different kinds of societies than one that we live in. But the problem that poses is that I, like a lot of people on the left, I try to avoid just writing blueprints for the future. You know, mm-hmm. Karl Marx had a line where he said you shouldn't write recipes for the kitchens of the future. In part because they almost never turn out the way you expect, but also because if you really believe, as I do, that a new kind of future society has to be democratically made by the masses of people that will bring it into being, that's not consistent with thinking you know exactly how it's going to play out in
you
advance.
Know, actually, Peter, could you elaborate on that, just to take a side tangent for a second? Because I still think in popular culture and pop intellectual culture, particularly in the United States, there's still this notion very much, and obviously some of it is rooted in historical examples of, Soviet abuse and totalitarianism or purges in China or, places where governments with that mantle of a kind of, a communist mantle have sort of had very strict linear plans and egregiously violated human rights. So there's still this popular conception that the left is like this sort of ultimate maker of clear blueprints. But when you actually get into the literature and the actual argumentation, it's quite the opposite. So I'd love if you could take just a brief side tangent and elaborate on that. That would be great.
Sure. I mean, there certainly have been and still are, people who do sort of write blueprints and want to sketch out in detail what the new society would look like. And there are some people that will say, well, you can't criticize capitalism unless you can tell me exactly what will replace it.
Right.
But for me, it's much more helpful to start by identifying key features of the present that I think that I don't like, that I think impede human freedom and human flourishing, and think about how we might move beyond those and then where that might lead. Mm-hmm. So, my starting point in the book is specifically the institution of wage labor, the fact that so many of us spend so much of our time in the essentially unfree condition of having sold our time to a boss who tells us what to do. And that one of the dreams of the socialist movement and the left more broadly has always been to minimize and ultimately, if possible, completely overcome that kind of labor and that kind of unfreedom. And so I start with that in the book in combination with, these conversations that have started to pop up again recently about automation, robots,
right,
computers, algorithms, all these ways of replacing human labor, and then saying, okay, well, if that's possible, if we have these technologies, what are the possibilities in terms of either making us more free or not?
Right. So that's where you sort of get, and I guess we can keep sort of, you can reference the science fiction literature and everything else as we sort of delineate these categories, because you basically outline, you identify the two sort of foundational crises of our time in the climate crisis and inequality as these sort of defining overarching issues, the sort of organizing problems or challenges we face in a certain sense. I'm not sure that's how you put it, but these sort of fundamental backdrops. Then you say we have there's abundance futures and scarcity futures, and then two different versions of each. Can you explain the sort of outlines of those four futures and how they're sort of mirrored in the speculative fiction you mentioned before?
Sure. So again, starting with this sort of premise of what if we could kind of automate everything, what if it were possible to escape from labor? And that's complicated in terms of what I actually think about that debate, but I sort of use it as a premise to get into the more science fictional stuff.
Right.
And then I say, yeah, there's these two parameters. There's this 2x2 grid, this box that I draw. You have that ecology axis that is either on the scarcity side or the abundance side, which means do we actually get to renewable energy, find ways to mitigate climate change, find ways to, you know, better produce and recycle and so on, so that we can, you know, actually have a sort of a truly post-scarcity life. Whereas the other option is, even if you have the machines that can produce with no labor at the push of a button, we don't have infinite resources to feed that. And so then the politics becomes much more about making sure that each of us gets shared out equally as much as we can have, given the ecological constraint. And so that's the one axis. Then the other axis is the political one, or as I sometimes say, the class struggle axis.
Mm-hmm.
With, on one end, equality, the historic dream of the left of, you know, as much as possible, equality of condition between people. And at the other end, hierarchy, what we have now, the 1% or the 0.01%. versus the rest, and where resources and power are monopolized by a tiny elite. And it's in the interaction between those axes that you get the four different sort of stylized futures. So to start in the most utopian square, if you have abundance and you have equality, you have what I call communism, in the sense of the sort of old Marxist idea that in true communism with a small c, it's from each according to her ability to each according to his need. We are not compelled to do anything other than the free development of our own talents, right? And so this is where these sort of science fiction futures where, you know, 3D printers turn into things like the Star Trek replicator, and we have nanobots, and we have all these ways where basically we, you know, we sort of develop our collective projects not on the basis of money in the way that we see fit. And people look around today and see things like, you know, open source software, Wikipedia, you know, various kind of collectives, you know, producing whatever it is, community gardens or whatever, and say these are little pockets of communism in our world. And so that chapter is looking at what is it like if you blow those up, and where are the kind of conflicts and contradictions of that, which are no longer about capitalism, but it doesn't mean that there aren't sort of hierarchies and conflicts that arise in that scenario.
Actually, Peter, that's another thing I'd like you to go off on that tangent as well. Another really interesting thing that you raise in this book, and you use fiction skillfully to illustrate the point, is another sort of generic thing that you will hear about, in some ways, even these frames around any of these systems are kind of silly in a certain way. But one of these things that you'll hear is like, you know, well, communism will never work because, you know, we know such and such a thing about human nature, which is, you know, I mean, you in some way you could just, as you, you know, you could say capitalism will never work because we know such and such a thing about human nature. I mean, these are very kind of metaphysical comments. They're not really grounded. But one of the points that statement sort of directs us to, which is legitimate and you deal with, is that even if you escape or redesign a process away from money or labor exchange, there's still hierarchies. There's still social competition that it will manifest in different ways. So the question is more, can these things be, at least this is how I read it, are there ways of setting up institutions where you know, we recognize legitimate hierarchies all the time, right? Like if we had this functioning, you know, Star Trek, great, abundant, sort of more equalitarian, you know, equal society, it wouldn't mean that we were all physicians, because some people still have those skills and others don't, right? And so that's like kind of, you could say that's a natural hierarchy. There still will be, you know, in an open culture, debates and conflict around politics and ideas. So anyways, I'd like you to just get into that, that just because these sort of particular types of very zero-sum competition have been taken away does not mean that it's sort of like a bland, faceless mass that doesn't have natural hierarchies or just natural human conflict.
Yeah. So the way I sort of put it is, you know, a lot of times when you call yourself socialist, or people will say, oh, but you mean that, you just mean capitalism causes all the problems, right? We get rid of capitalism, we get rid of all the problems. But right. That's not what I think.
Right.
The metaphor I use in the book is the metaphor of the capital relation between capital and labor as like a magnet. Mm-hmm. Those are like the two poles of a magnet. And it produces a magnetic field that tends to draw other conflicts and other hierarchies toward it, right? Which doesn't mean that, say, you know, sexism is totally reducible to capitalism, but that it tends to go to be moved into alignment with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is with all these other conflicts. And it's that that makes the stakes so high in all of them, because they all come back to that basic conflict of how do we make a living? How do we survive? And so part of what makes me sort of hopeful, but even though I'm trying to be realistic about the kinds of conflicts that arise in a post-scarcity society, is that they're more sort of fragmented, and therefore it's possible to sort of opt out of situations in a way that it isn't often in a capitalist society.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it more possible to really deal with some of this stuff and overcome things that just seem like intractable problems of the human condition under capitalism. But at the same time, you know, I always like to say new problems we can't even imagine will arise. It's project of overcoming capitalism is for me a project of finding new and better human problems.
Right. Like I think there's an old, like, I forget who said it, but something to the effect of like the goal of society should be to sort of move people out of like relentless, brutal, you know, oppressive misery so they can go and have like productive, healthy suffering. Which is like,
right. It's sort of like, comes, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, my friend Corey Robin, the political scientist, has a line like that, that I think he sort of draws from Freud, which is, it's the project of going from hysterical misery to ordinary unhappiness.
Right. And there's a lot more kind of human productivity in wrestling with that unhappiness. So, okay. So we have this scenario where we've created some type of, and to be really specific, when you talk about that abundance, you're talking about things like the possibilities of 3D printing. You're talking about, on one hand, that those two sort of poles, because the other paradox is that in the information economy, scarcity is sort of completely artificially created. And then on the other hand, that would be great for you to elaborate on, and as you get into some of the bad scenarios. And then on the other hand, where scarcity is, you know, not at all artificially created. It's quite literally like we are destroying at a sort of just amazing pace the basics of like the Earth's functional systems. In the abundance ideal scenario, we figured out a fusion where it's like, you know, the 3D printers run on wind power, run on solar, and we have sort of come up with that fusion, and it's run sort of equitably. Now, move into the first scenario of we've generated abundance, but we still have artificial scarcity in the information economy, and we have to generate and sustain a lack of equality in terms of access, which is in many ways the world that we're seeing enacted very much day to day now.
And that's also part of a point I would make about the book in general. Each future is supposed to isolate something that is happening right now.
Right.
And kind of, you know, in the way it's often said, science fiction is always really about the time in which it's written.
Mm-hmm.
And so these futures are just sort of in concentrated form issues in the present. So in the case of what you're talking about, this is actually where this whole project started for me, was that question of artificial scarcity and how class power is sort of maintained in the potentially abundant future.
Mm-hmm.
And it was started with, you know, I was considering the Star Trek TV show where they have you know, they are in a communist society, basically, as far as I am concerned. They have their replicators. They have their magical antimatter generators. They can get in spaceships and fly around in a military hierarchy if they feel like it, apparently. But I don't get the sense that anybody's really required to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then I started thinking, okay, well, what if it wasn't a communist society? What if the technology were the same, but the class structures were totally different? They were more like our world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led me to this question of, okay, you don't need human labor to produce anymore. You have these replicators. How does the ruling class stay the ruling class? And it's through these forms of artificial scarcity and forms of property that take the form of rent. So this rentism is the name I use for this regime. Right, because rent we think of traditionally in terms of things like land, where you don't produce anything. It's just if you own the land, you can charge for access to it.
Right.
If you own the apartment, you can charge for access to it, whether or not you're actually like putting anything into it, as opposed to actually like producing a product and selling it.
Right.
But that form of property extends far beyond land, especially now, and intellectual property has the same form. You own the rights to copy, you know, the digital file of a movie. It doesn't actually cost anything or almost anything to do that. It's just there's a legal property form that says I can't copy that without paying the fee.
Right.
And likewise, how it doesn't matter how little it might cost to produce a life-saving medicine, the company that owns the patent decides what the price of it is.
Right.
And so the thought experiment in that part of the, you know, that corner of the Four Futures is how what happens is that kind of blows up to become more and more of the economy. What happens in a world where essentially, as I... You know, there's a Charles Stross novel that I open that chapter with that opens with the main character sort of on the run from the copyright police.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I take that chapter, the kind of the forms of the legal forms and the economic forms that would be necessary and what the contradictions would be of an economy like that.
Right. So that's and we can see that's the sort of core contradiction. Those sort of two contradictions are where they're sort of the most explosive things we're dealing with, because on one hand we're developing this hyper information economy where things like all of a sudden now, you know, even something like a replicator like thing in Star Trek every day seems less and less, you know, implausible, even relative to, like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, or certainly, I mean, even if you were watching it and you were, you know, I don't know, 6 or 7 when the latest version of Star Trek came out, that Next Generation show. And then, again, conversely, we're building that on top of a completely collapsing basic ecological infrastructure, the scale of the crisis of which we're, you know, barely at best beginning to address. And then in that information area, we're again, as you say, we're creating this entirely artificial means of scarcity just to justify having a monetized system around it, which is not even sort of logical to its development, because a lot of these technologies and programs and initial developments came out of, again, more of that sort of open or culture, or if you want to say communistic sort of space. Then you have scenarios where you're sort of saying we haven't, I'm not sure I'm reading this right, but it's like we haven't quite dealt with the ecological crisis, or our lives are just increasingly defined by material scarcity of the world because we have not been able to reverse those crises. We haven't been able to regenerate things. We haven't. And then again, you have two scenarios, which is we've sort of figured out and evolved our politics, so the consequences of that are far less brutal. And then we have another scenario where we are living in this, you know, almost like Children of Men like future, which is the best I can do for a speculative fiction reference, my friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I mean, that's not a bad one. So, right. So the simplest way I would put this scarcity end of the table that I'm talking about here is basically we have the replicators and everything.
Right.
But the carbon cost of the replicators, or the amount of, you know, rare materials that they require, means that you can't just replicate whatever you want whenever you want. Somebody has to decide who gets to make what.
Right.
So, and that brings me to a couple of questions that animate the sort of scarcity with equality box that I draw, which is, you know, this is where the relationship between socialism and ecology comes to the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about, you know, my view on sort of environmentalism being that we have to be very real about the fact that dealing with the crisis that that capitalism has created is going to mean an even deeper involvement with sort of managing nature and becoming involved with us sort of continuing to remake the earth in order that it can support us. And then I talk a little bit about.
So that's like a big objection to like a Derek Jensen style sort of step back from the earth and kind of fold into the woodwork and let it do its thing, like a sort of neo-romanticism. Is that what you're objecting
to? Even among people that aren't really hardcore primitivists or deep ecologists, you still get it in the rhetoric a lot. You know, we talk about we need to lighten our carbon footprint, mm-hmm. as though the problem is that, you know, is that humans are separate from nature, and then the problem is that we're mucking with it too much, when the problem is actually that we are completely a part of nature, and that's why we have to accept that and accept that we are the only species that has the potential capability to address this crisis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it gets me that, yeah, so it means, and what that means in terms of like how ambitious we become in terms of trying to manipulate the climate, for example, is something I'm still wrestling with and researching, but it's something that I want to sort of open the space for. But then I also, in that same chapter, want to talk about these old kind of issues of like what a socialist economy looks like, what the role of planning versus markets look like,
mm-hmm.
And to try to suggest that a lot of the problems that arose in those discussions in the 20th century had to do with the relationship to production and labor.
Mm-hmm.
Who decides what gets produced? Who decides the division of labor? But that if you think of these of planning schemes or market schemes more in terms of planning consumption, of this question of we can't all replicate whatever we want, different people want different things, how do we decide, you know, how much of what gets made? That there's ways to do that with some combination of democratic planning and market mechanisms,
mm-hmm.
that would not, if it was happening outside of a capitalist context, wouldn't have the negative features that we associate either with economic planning or with markets.
So that's really like just seriously updated. But in, as an example, again, just pointing with the argument of the book that you're isolating worlds that exist now. And that's the world that seems to me just like a really updated, rigorous social democracy, a bit more like we do already see in some Scandinavian countries to some extent.
Yeah, I think that's right, especially now that some of them are starting to move in the direction of being less sort of work-focused. You know, you have things like the universal basic income being right. seriously discussed among social democrats. And so to the extent that that part of social democracy starts to evolve in a more post-war direction, then, yeah, what you have left are these sort of questions of ecological and economic management, I think.
And again, also the lifestyle questions, too, because then it's like the other thing that, like, and part of the foundation of the book, that if we're supposedly moving into this post-work world, that could either be mass wasted human life, or it could be a complete sort of burgeoning and opening of compensated social capital and society building, where all sorts of right. talents and abilities to, you know, educate people, create projects, you know, all of the rest could be sort of all of this sort of rhetoric and energy of entrepreneurship and social innovation that's sort of very narrowly funneled through like a venture capital lens or a really tight philanthropic lens could get massively opened up and just sort of invested in as an arm of just broad mass social innovation and government investment.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, part of the argument that needs to be made is that there's a tremendous human potential that you unlock when you give people both the time and the sort of skills and resources to really pursue their passion, not in that cynical sense of passion means you work for me and I don't have to pay you, but in like we actually have the freedom to build the projects that we want. Because yeah, otherwise you get into the last sort of square of my 2x2, the world in which, you know, the existence of ecological limits means that the sort of rentist future of absurd intellectual property doesn't quite work because the ruling class has to reduce its own standard of living in order to supply all of these other people that it wants to exploit.
Right.
So the alternative vision is, yeah, you said Children of Men, I sort of used the film Elysium at the start of that chapter to talk a little bit about it. A world in which the, you know, I talk about the dangers, the great danger of the moment we're in, one of them anyway, is that historically the a capitalist economy has been characterized by a relationship of mutual dependence between the boss and the worker.
Right.
In the sense that the worker needs a job, doesn't have any other way to earn the means of subsistence, and so needs the capitalist. And the capitalist needs the worker to make, run the factories, to run the shops, and all of that. But if human labor is eliminated or massively reduced in the system, what that breaks that dependence, and it creates a situation in which the rich don't need us anymore. They have their robots, they have their replicators, and we are just surplus populations to them.
Right. Right.
And that leads to people who are warehoused in prisons, people who are warehoused in refugee camps. You know, people are allowed to die of preventable diseases or die in natural disasters caused by climate change.
So like the Republican platform, basically.
What's that?
Like the Republican platform, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Trump is, you know, Trump is more of a rentier guy, but they're ready to veer in the other direction if necessary.
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe more. I actually am thinking of Paul Ryan more than Trump. I mean,
Ted Cruz was the ultimate exterminist candidate to me.
Right, 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 right. That makes total sense. And in all senses. If we were going to take this down to the sort of, you know, and I don't want to sort of operationalize this conversation too much or try to make it too practical, because I don't think that that's really the point of this argument in some respects and this reading. I think it just is a brilliant way of enlarging the scope and understanding of what's happening in our world now and where we could be heading. And in fact, and again, in actually a grounded and non-cynical sense, the notion that we do actually have some ability and some power to sort of shape the reality of our world and where it's going. But if we were going to take it into the realm of like, and I don't think these are mutually exclusive, but do you see like, okay, so there are these four pressure points that we can see where like, okay, there's work and create these projects that sort of model the world we want, or at least a much bigger part of the world than exists now. And that's the space of, you know, starting a worker-run business, create a community-generated garden, invest in parts of the information economy that are run on commons. Then there's, you know, I guess in the rent piece, you know, build movements, push reformist policies on rent affordability, increasing wages, and then connected with that, really aggressively safeguard the remnants of social democracy that we have now, and then push, like, you know, the Bernie agenda. And then in the fourth point, it seems like that's an area where there's a lot of just sort of burgeoning work and a lot of just sort of direct action and conflict on, you know, serious human rights advocacy, whether it's Black Lives Matter or, you know, objecting to the, you know, mass sort of abuse of refugees and migrants across the globe. I mean, I'm just wondering, like, where are the pressure points and points of entry to start sort of directing things from this framework where we want them to go?
I mean, I think you sort of identified the key strands of movements that are already happening, right? That these kind of commons-based projects are happening, environmental justice movements are happening, movements against militarism both at home and abroad are happening, movements for freedom of access to information or for access to medicines in poor countries and so on are happening. And I don't pretend to sort of be the master strategist for any of these movements. They'll continue to happen both independently and interactingly. I guess part of, though, the vision for me is, you know, in the wake of Bernie Sanders in the United States, we have all these people who are coming and, you know, calling themselves socialists for the first time, who find that, like, idea of that as an, of the idea of a broad alternative to our system compelling, but don't necessarily have a good sense of what exactly that means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it excites me that we have this going on. I've been a socialist for 20 years, but I think I'm hopeful that I can take some of the stuff that I've thought about this over the years and try to draw a picture that says, how do all these things sort of fit together into a broader vision of what the main problems and struggles facing us right now are, and what a different and better resolution of those conflicts might be.
Yeah. I mean, is there any point of, I guess not as a grand strategy question, but even so, even just as a point of interest, is there any of those particular pressure points that you think is the most promising or the most interesting or the most compelling or no?
I think it moves sort of over, you know, what we've seen in recent years, certainly since 2008 and the crisis, is this sort of like movement from sort of place to place, right? Yeah. In terms of what movements, you know, you have Occupy bringing the inequality question to the forefront, and you have Black Lives Matter, which is like really pushing on the kind of violence and militarization and dehumanization part of it, you know, and then you have Bernie, who is the sort of like, yeah, let's save and strengthen social democracy kind of thing. And it remains to be seen what the sort of next iteration of that is, under, you know, what looks to be, you know, a Hillary Clinton administration, where we'll have probably, I would say, more of the same, but with a bit more war. And we're going to have to react to that, in some ways.
Right. Well, Peter Fraze, the book is called The Four Futures: Life After Capitalism. I strongly recommend it to anyone sort of trying to get a grip on today's world and what's coming next. And also, you, my co-host on Two Dope Boys is a major Star Trek fan. And after I read your book, I finally went into Netflix and I tried to get through a couple of Next Generation episodes. And fascinating, but a little rough. Not going to lie.
Start in season one. That's the first piece of advice.
Whew. Well, I wish I had that advice before, Peter. Where should I start?
Get to season three at least. That's okay. When they started to really know what they were doing.
Okay, because it's a little... It's stripping away the Patrick Stewart romanticism at this point. Okay, I appreciate that, man. I'm going to give season three a try. Peter Fraze, get the book. There's a link to it on the Majority.fm website. Author of The Four Futures, editor at The Jackman. Peter, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Okay, everybody, we are going to go to the fun half. The IMs are on. The phone number is 646-257-3920. Become a member of the Majority Report today at majority.fm/become a member. Justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. We have a lot of sound for you in the fun half. And
if you want to hear Nicki Minaj swearing, you'll want to stick around for the fun half. And if you don't want to, you'll want to like cover your kids' ears or something.
Yes, fair warning. Now, let me just say once again before we close out the first half, I want to thank again Secrets, Crimes, and Audiotapes. It's a brand new amazing podcast for sponsoring today's episode. Secrets, Crimes, and Audiotapes is an audio drama told week after week. I was telling you about the one that involved JFK. It's great. It features stories about crime, love, mystery, or conspiracy with actors that you know and love. Some of them are dramas, some of them are comedies. Make sure you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe to Secrets, Crimes, and Audiotapes. An audiotape. Secrets, Crime, and Audiotape on iTunes, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. There's a link on our website. We'll see you in the fun half.